don't understand. I could have had class. I could have been a contender. I could have been somebody.
Jay, he's almost like having a second captain in the team.
Second captain, first captain, whatever.
As you probably know by now, July is the pinnacle of the Irish sporting calendar these days, with the All-Ireland hurling and football finals on consecutive weekends. Uh-huh. And carefully placed in between both of these sacred occasions is the next best title on this island, the title of greatest non-sportsperson sportsperson. Our thanks to all the stakeholders in Irish broadcasting, and indeed Irish sport, who put this series at the end of the All-Ireland intercounty season just to keep the nation's spirits up, Murph.
Listen, Uachtaráin, come on, Luke Lascale, thank you for including us in your holy trinity.
Oh, my Devon Carroll Murphy here. Back with another season of Second Captain Saturday. This is the show that goes where no show has gone before, by revealing previously unheard tales from the sporting lives of some of Ireland and the world's most celebrated public figures. Where else would you hear about Conan O'Brien's dreams of becoming a professional wrestler called Hamhands?
Nowhere else.
Or the great playwright Enda Walsh and his secret past as the official wolfhound mascot of the Irish football team. I don't know why you needed to know about that, but you know it now. Mm. Once again this summer, we put together a lineup of incredible guests. Yes, we will ask them about their own careers and the achievements that brought them into the public eye in the first place, but mainly just as an excuse to rank their sporting achievements against each other in order to find our greatest non-sportsperson sportsperson for 2025.
I could have been a contender. I could have been somebody.
Yeah, well, and it's a whole new season, so it's probably time for a refresher course, right? I assess each guest using the following three criteria. I will closely analyse their sporting achievements. I will assign to them a sports chair that I feel most closely resembles them. And then, having considered their all-time sporting highlight, I will give them a score out of 100. They're going to go up against the seven other guests in this series, and the top point scorer this season will be crowned the champion. And as I have said many times before, the guests who know the least about sport are often our favourites. So you need know nothing about sport to be a guest, or indeed be a listener. Last year's winner was Irish institution and tennis alpha dog Ardal O'Hanlon, who narrowly pipped the bustling Gaelic football bear on the square Brendan Gleeson with a shock late charge. Previous winners have included elite middle distance runner Malcolm Gladwell, former wrestler Aisling Bee, Arsenal trialist Michael Sheen of Hollywood, the wonderful artist and legitimate Olympic swimming prospect Dorothy Cross. We're dealing with high quality individuals here. Okay, Owen. Anything over 80 is an excellent score. We tend not to score under 70 out of, well, pity. And if you edge closer to 90, then there's every chance you will finish the year with silverware. Silverware, Owen.
I felt Gleeson was hard done by last year, Murph. Well, I've got to be honest with you. I'm sure he did too, but there you go. First up, to stake a claim to the silverware, this time as a man who grew up in London with no Irish background, only to become a central member of one of the most revered Irish bands of all time. Spider Stacey is on the show today, almost exactly 40 years on from the release of the Pogues' masterpiece, Rum, Sodomy and the Lash, an album that was actually produced by Elvis Costello, Murph.
Yes.
Don't know if you knew that.
Yes, on.
Yeah, he said his main job at the time was to capture the Pogues in their dilapidated glory before some more professional producer effed them up. I don't know if he actually said effed, but that's what I'm saying here on daytime.
Well, like, yeah, like that's such a brilliant quote, actually. The Pogues are, like, they're obviously insanely watchable anytime you've ever seen them live. But they famously appeared on the Late Late Show's tribute to the Dubliners, played the Irish Rover with
them.
Yeah,
we put this back on Second Captain's Instagram.
Yeah.
You couldn't watch this enough times.
It's just such astonishing television. You know, so Spider and Shane McGowan are up front and centre, mugging at each other, basically having the time of their lives. They're sticking their tongues at each other in between verses. It just looks like the most insane fun, and it is the definitive, most raucous version of that song. It's just so good. And Spider's charisma and presence, like, he is an Englishman in this most Irish of settings.
Yeah, completely. I want to get into that as well.
Yeah, like, it just really stood out.
Transpired.
To me, you
know? Spider's still going strong, by the way, touring the album again with the Pogues. They're off to the States in September to play some pretty cool venues like the Lincoln Theatre in Washington, D.C., Terminal 5 in New York. So we're going to chat to him about what it's like to be touring and playing those songs written by his great friend Shane McGowan, who I'm sure would have been as happy as anyone about Tipp's victory in the All-Ireland Hurling Final last week. We'll also reveal Spider's sporting claim to fame during the peak years of Irish sport. That's all to come. You can email into us, editor@secondcaptains.com. Message us @secondcaptains on Instagram. It's a brand new series of Second Captain Saturday. We've got to start with the Pogues and a Tipp song for the week that's in it. Back in a bit, Spider Stacey.
The last time I saw you was down at the Greeks. There was whiskey and sunburn.
That's The Broad Majestic Shannon by The Pogues, written by Shane McGowan. On backing vocals and tin whistle was Spider Stacey. Spider, you're very welcome to Second Captains. How's the form?
It's pretty good. It's pretty good. How's yourself?
Not too bad. Now, can you confirm, first of all, you are a Tip fan?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. It has to be Tipperary.
Were you aware The Broad Majestic Shannon is one of the Tip hurling anthems now? I mean, that's got to feel pretty cool.
Yeah, that really is. I was aware of that because Siobhan told me. And of course, there's the Tip jersey with the lyrics on it. I think Shane would be delighted with that.
Yeah, that was the local J club, Shannon Rovers. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, like, it that actually really means something, I think.
Yeah. What does it say to you?
I mean, I'm kind of delighted on Shane's behalf, obviously. But it's just, you know, I think that's in a lot of ways, that's probably my favorite Pogue song is The Broad Majestic Shannon. And I know it was a song that was it's a very personal song to him, obviously. You know, you look at the lyrics and it's about things that meant so much to him. It was sort of central part of his life, of his identity. And it is also, I think, a really just a beautiful song about exile and loss and longing. And it's so many things wrapped up, you know, in those few verses. So it's really nice to see it. Getting the recognition from the people that it's who it's kind of about, you know.
You're touring with the Pogues this year, celebrating 40 years since Rum, Sodomy and the Lash, Spider. Yes. Playing incredible venues. You're going to be playing in the States in September. How's it been going for you so far?
The UK leg was absolutely fantastic. We got really, really good reviews. The gigs themselves were, I don't know, it was like stepping back into the 80s, to be honest. It was like they were the reaction of the audiences was more like something from 86 or 87 than, say, the reunion years. Just the sort of the vibe on stage is as anarchic and as fun as it was back then. Yeah, I've really loved every minute, and I don't want to sort of like, I have a tendency to gush, which kind of like comes across as being a bit, I don't know, sometimes. But it's very difficult to do anything else. You know, when you're on stage and you've got like Lisa O'Neill singing A Rainy Night in Soho is I think balm for any ill that might assail you, you know. They're all so great. The musicians, you know, it's just, I can't speak highly enough of them.
You're in a very different place now in your life from a beautiful phrase that you used once, the dreaming turbulence of our early 20s. What does it mean to be back there, but with a very different kind of life experience now?
I've not really sort of processed that properly. This really did come out of the left field. This whole thing, you know, it was Tom Cole and his friend Campbell Baum, Tom Cole from Fontaines, who were just doing a weekend of Irish music at a little folk club in Hackney, who suggested it. It being 40 years since Red Roses for Me last year, that I might like to curate the Friday night using some of the people that they had on their bill in the Moth Club. And yeah, I thought this sounds like a good idea. And it just, there wasn't really any intention of at all of involving any of the other Pogues. I didn't see that, you know, we didn't have any kind of a budget, so we wouldn't have been able to get James over from Los Angeles. I knew Jem was busy with his various things that he's doing. There was something about it that sounded really appealing. And it just, when we announced it and it sold out immediately and we realized we had to move it to a bigger venue, so we got a bit more money, and then it suddenly just took wings and took off. It's almost like in some ways heading back into the dreaming turbulence, but at a later stage, as it were. But it's, I don't know. No, I haven't really sort of had time to analyze it. I don't even know that I necessarily want to, you know what I mean? It's, I'm just so pleased it's happening. I'm so, it's really an appropriate way to sort of like, because, you know, realistically, this will be the last hurrah. These, you know, however, you know, we'll probably carry on, I imagine, for another sort of 2 or 3 years. I can't realistically seeing it going much longer than that, because, you know, I'll be 67 in December. Jem just hit 70. I think James already is 70. So best will in the world, we're not going to be able to keep doing it for that much longer. So
you've said that before, I'm sure, Spider, that it's the last.
Well, yeah, but
the
I mean, there, there,
it's
there
been
are certain
going on for
times,
a long time.
There are certain times when there are certain realities will impose themselves upon you that there is no kind of getting round or over or under. like death being one of them, or just like, you know, being so aged and infirm that the notion, say in James's case, of wielding a 40-ton accordion above your head becomes an impossibility.
It's really interesting that you say that it has a feel of what it was like back in the 80s, but obviously with newer modern musicians, Lisa O'Neill, Lancome's Dara Lynch, it must be a really beautiful thing to see the music being taken in new directions by these people. And not just that, but for you to be part of that as well. And for musicians of that caliber to jump at the chance to get involved with you in the Pogues and something like this.
Well, this is it. You've hit the nail right on the head. This is what's so brilliant about it, is that we are able to sort of ask all these extraordinary musicians to do this. And they're more than, you know, they're jumping at the chance to do it. It's funny, actually, Dara Lynch, when we sort of say, yeah, do you fancy playing guitar on, this is on the UK tour, he says, yeah, no, I'd love to. Will I have to stand up? We're like, yes, Dara, you'll have to stand up. I've never really played guitar standing up before. Well, you know, you're going to have to get used to it. It's been brilliant. It's really funny because we had the Mary Wallopers. We had Charles sang Fairy Tale in New York with Rady Pete at Christmas in Dublin last year. And then we had Charles and Andrew both came up for the final show of the UK tour, which was in Glasgow. And they were both really, really nervous beforehand. I'm giving away your secrets, lads. And I think a few of the others were as well. And it's like Lisa was like, you know, oh, people were, you know, the singers making to do like last, literally at the last minute before we're actually due to sort of saying, oh, can we change the key? Can I change the key to Dirty Old Town? It's like, no, not really. You have to. Sorry, it can't be done. Yeah. And then just hear them just sort of step out. And it's just this extraordinary thing. And it's just, it's been brilliant. It's been brilliant.
Can we go back, Spider? Because I'm really interested in how you became such a big part of Irish music and Irish culture with no Irish family background yourself. I don't know, was there any Irish influence growing up for you?
No. I grew up in Northwest London. So when I started going to pubs sort of around 15, 16, just by virtue of where I was living, not the immediate area, which was more Jewish really than anything else, I guess, sort of Temple Fortune and Golders Green, but it's right next to places like Cricklewood, for example, which is, you know, obviously a very famously Irish area in Northwest London, and which is, Cricklewood itself is just up the road from Kilburn. So we'd spend quite a lot of time going to pubs in places like that. You know, you'd hear stuff on the jukebox, you'd hear, this, bearing in mind we're talking about the sort of like the mid 70s here, so yeah, it's safe to say we were exposed to Irish culture.
You spent some of your childhood a lot further afield than North London, though, right?
Yeah, when I was little, I lived in Guyana for a couple of years. No, for about a year. And then when I was a little bit old, when I was slightly less little, we lived in Libya for a couple of years. My dad got a succession of these weird-ass jobs that people used to get. My dad's story was all these guys who had been in the army in the war and just came out, I think, rather sort of lost and at a loss as to what to do with themselves. My dad came from a very working class background, and his family were from Stockwell on his dad's side and Haggerston in East London on his mum's side. You know, he was in an orphanage when he was a kid because his mum didn't have enough money to put all her, you know, I think the oldest son was what they wanted to put him through university or something. So the two youngest, just my dad and his sister, were put in a Spurgeon's home for a couple of years just to help his mum make ends meet. So to go from that kind of background, and he joined up when war was declared, and he made sergeant very quickly. And at that, and then they needed officers for the Indian Army, where all the, being pre-independence, all the officers were British. And so they needed officers to stock up there. So they asked a bunch of these guys, you know, do you fancy your chances? And he went out, and I think it gave him this, I don't know, I think, you know, I could just imagine what it must have been like. You go from Stockwell and then you go to a place like, you know, you arrive in Mumbai and then get on a train and you go to, I think it's Dehradun, where they had the officer academy. I mean, like, I know India had a really profound impact on him, and this led, I think, to this sense of sort of rootlessness and restlessness, maybe is actually even a better word, a kind of combination of the two, really, actually. Plus, God only knows what sort of variant of PTSD I think a lot of people came back, you know, who actually saw action came back with. Yeah, so that's kind of how he ended. He just took all these strange jobs in faraway places.
When you say strange jobs, what was he doing in Guyana,
well,
for example?
Well, I mean, it's all a bit unclear. In Guyana, it was his job to sort of like pay these guys who were working on the sugar plantations, which is a thin strip along the coast, who were mostly indentured labourers from the Indian subcontinent. And, you know, cutting sugarcane is famously a brutally hard work. And they probably weren't getting paid a whole lot of money anyway. And it was his job to sort of like go out and pay them their money and also to hire and fire because it was seasonal. And it just sounds like, I don't really quite know why he was doing, you know, I'm sure that he could have found himself a better job than that. But it's like I say, I think there was a lot of people just ended up in these kind of frankly bizarre situations. I mean, we were living way up the Pomeroon River, way up in the jungle. And I've, to this day, I've absolutely no idea why we would have been in such a remote and frankly sketchy location, but there we were.
Did you ever ask your dad about why he did that kind of work? Because it also strikes me as that, considering where you ended up in your life as you got older, as you became an adult and into the Irish trad music scene, there's so much there, the Dubliners and Dominic Bean and all this writing and singing about Irish labourers in the UK working in, shall we say, difficult conditions. Do you ever equate the two, or did you ever talk to your father about the sort of work he did over there?
Well, not really, because I mean, say in Guyana, I know he sort of told me stuff about it. I didn't sort of like really question the whys or the wherefores, because I kind of saw that this was like, I guess, a situation he had to do something. He had been given a taste of a world beyond the world that he grew up with. And I think he always retained a fascination and a sort of, I mean, he loved India. Yeah.
How did you get into Irish music then, Spider? Was that just through Shane McGowan coming into your life, basically?
Not really so much. I mean, like, though he was obviously a very important part of it, but there was actually a friend of mine, a guy called Pete, who was half Irish on his mum's side. And he had a fair few sort of like Dubliners and Clancy's records, things like that. And I didn't particularly, I remember when I was sort of about 13, 14, I didn't really get the Clancy's, but the Dubliners, there was always something about the Dubliners that really just like, I don't know, it struck a chord, particularly Ronnie's voice. But just there's something about the attitude there. And it's an interesting one that now I come to think of it, because it definitely sort of like it snuck in and sort of buried itself down deep. And then so later on, when I started hanging out with Shane and sort of he'd be playing all the stuff like, you know, Come Out Your Black and Tans by Declan Hunt and whatnot. Yeah, it was all kind of very familiar.
You famously first encountered Shane McGowan at a Ramones gig in 1977 at the Roundhouse in London. What was Shane's reputation then? I mean, what did he look like? What did he act like when you met him at that time?
Well, he was, you know, he was quite a face in London at the time. He'd been on the front cover of Sounds in, you know, the old music paper, and I think December 76. I think it actually said, is this the face of 77? I think more in terms of like, is this what we're going to be doing in 77? Because he wasn't in a band or anything like that at that point, you know. But he was just, I guess they felt he was, this is a pretty good representation of what this thing that's happening is all about. And of course, he famously got his earlobe bitten off. He actually got his earring bitten out by Jane from the Modettes at a Clash gig at the ICA, I think. Yeah, at the ICA.
So sorry, just to clarify that one then, that's an important distinction. He didn't have his earlobe bitten off.
No. But he had an earring in, and they were kind of like biting at each other and stuff, as you do, you know. And she bit his earring out of his ear. And you know, you got all these, there's so many little blood vessels up there that it looked a lot worse than it actually was. It was nothing like a small sort of nick in the skin, really, but it bled like she had bottled him or indeed had bitten his whole ear off, never mind the lobe.
Maybe a forgivable mistake.
We've
all met people that we just immediately want to impress. You know, for whatever reason, we seek validation from these people almost immediately. Was that the way it was with you and Shane? How soon did you realise kind of how special a musician he was?
Oh, I didn't. I mean, like that very first meeting was extremely brief. It was actually twice in the same night. So I guess technically that's first and second. The first time he was in the gents talking about his fanzine, Bondage, and then later on I saw him outside. I'd just gone out for a breath of fresh air, and he was just like, "Are you enjoying yourself?" And I was like, "Yeah." And he's like, "That's what it's all about, isn't it?" And then we went our separate ways. But when a bunch of my friends moved to Burton Street in Bloomsbury, and then I started going down there, and I eventually sort of followed on. But Shane was living there, and that's when I got to know him. I knew about the Nips because they were getting a fair amount of press, and I was consuming the music weeklies. I always thought they were a really, really good band. He clearly had a real sort of ear for a tune, and could clearly write a song, you know. I didn't really properly appreciate just how great he actually was until he just started churning out these songs in the Pogues. Each one was just like, whoa, whoa, whoa. I mean, from the off, they were always so literate and kind of intelligent that you could see that there was something very, very special here.
Was that the greatness of Shane McGowan, do you think? Was it his songwriting more so than anything else?
No, I think he's an extraordinary human being in many ways, and I think the songwriting is one part of it. I think I don't think without his qualities as a human being, the songs would have been what they were, because he was capable of great empathy and compassion. He really sort of, I think, understood how people worked, how people's minds worked, how life could just like lie itself down on top of some people and not let them get up. So I think it's those qualities as a human being that fed into his work. I've heard people say, well, you know, if you look at it, maybe he didn't really do very much, you know, like there's, you know, I think, you know, the first three Pogues albums, and then the second two that he's on, and then there's the Pope's records, which then it's all, possibly one could say, a sort of tailing off, maybe. But at the same time, I mean, like, what do you expect of a man? It's a difficult thing when you're writing songs and they're coming from, because your head is in a particular place and your mind is on a particular track, if you like. When all the sort of situations, the circumstances of your life change and your perspective gets shifted without you even necessarily wanting it to be shifted, but it just kind of is anyway. You know, you're not going to be writing in the about the same thing. The same thing, I don't think, is going to be driving you as it was before. If what you're writing is really genuine, is coming from your soul, if you like.
Was there a moment in those early days that you realised there's something special here, or something big is happening?
I knew that there was. I knew that the band had an inherent quality to it from a very, very early stage. I could just feel it. It's not just the songs that we were playing. There was just something about the band, and I could sort of feel, I felt I could always say this because I could sort of stand outside and have a look at what was going on, as well as actually sort of standing inside and being a part of it. I was able to detach and observe. And I remember saying to, I think it was Jem on the Elvis Costello tour, we were driving on our way to somewhere, and I said, you know, I think we're the best band in the world. And later, at the end of the tour, the last show on that tour, which was at the UEA in Norwich, and Costello's road crew had they liked us, but we had really annoyed them because we were constantly nicking their beer. So they wheeled this big sort of, well, wheelie bin really, into our dressing room, just that they'd just stacked it full of cans of lager and whatever. So we all got very, very drunk, and there was a toilet in the dressing room, but like a toilet stall built into the dressing room, but the dressing room wasn't a bathroom. It was just a weird setup. And Jem sort of tapped me on the shoulder and said, come with me. And we crawled across the floor of the dressing room, crawled into the toilet. And we sat there sort of kneeling on the floor, and he went, do you still think we're the best band in the world? And I said, yeah, I do. And he was like, yeah, you might be right. And then we kind of crawled out again and carried on drinking. But I do believe, and I still believe, that even if you don't want to say it to anyone, and even if you never do say it to anyone, you should sort of know at some level that there's no one else like you. I mean, you know, I think it's possible there are, you know, there's many, many best bands in the world. if you know what I mean, at any given point in time. It's a bit like that thing, you know, what's your favourite record? Exile on Main Street or whatever is my favourite album. No questions. That's it. But I don't really buy that. I think it's like, when I know when people ask me that question, it's like, and you'll say something because you'll want to answer the question, and that, all right, yeah, if I had to put on anything at the moment, I put on this, you know, I put on Mary Wallopers or whatever. But then you might put on something entirely different in half an hour's time. Does that make sense?
It does. It does. And I think anyone who has an answer to that question in all moods, at all stages of their life, actually don't get what albums are about, I think, actually.
Exactly. Yeah. You know, I don't see, you know, you could say, like, I don't know, Slayer.
Yeah.
I can't think of the name of a Slayer album off the top of my head, but that can't be true. Yeah. All the time you want to listen to Slayer? Maybe.
You talked about that feeling of doing something better, doing something different to anything that had been done before. Not everyone necessarily got what it was that you were doing. And there famously would have been a certain amount of snobbery, a certain amount of criticism. Although I have to say, Spider, looking back through some of the archives, there's not as much stinging criticism as I thought. I got this one from the Connacht Tribune, December 1985. They are the oddest looking group since Dolly Parton, the least accomplished musicians since the Sex Pistols, and the worst singers since Leonard Cohen got the flu. But the Pogues are phenomenally successful and will pack the Leisureland Salt Hill when they play there in January. So that was a strain of... I mean, you're getting compared to some greats there, I suppose, so you probably can't complain with that criticism. Was that water off a duck's back? I know
Absolutely,
it is now, but at the time...
Yeah. I mean, it's just funny, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, I think it's sort of meant, because also it's not like it's not nasty. It's not like, oh, these bunch of shits. You know, it's just like I think it's funny.
It still happens though, doesn't it? The younger bands tend to get hammered by the old guard. We saw it with John
Sheen. I saw it happen with the Mary Wallopers.
That was John Sheen describing them as mediocre musicians and singers.
And I just thought. I'll be honest, I was a bit disappointed to see John Sheehan saying that, because, the Mary Wallopers certainly aren't worse musicians than we were, and the Dubliners didn't have any problems with us at all. John Sheehan was always extremely affable and generous and friendly. So, it's a bit like, come on, lads, give them a fucking break.
You were initially supposed to share the frontman duties with Shane. How did that change? When did that change?
Oh, it changed pretty much after the first gig, when it became very apparent that I couldn't actually sing.
Well, that's not true, but...
I don't know, I didn't... It sounds weird, but I kind of didn't... I didn't know how to do it. I hadn't sort of figured out that there is actually a way of doing this that's in tune, and you don't have to shout all the time. I don't know. I was, my approach was all wrong, and therefore I possibly damaged my confidence. It's certainly, when it comes to things like writing songs, I was very reluctant to even attempt to write, to put down any words, because I felt for a long time that if somebody else starts writing lyrics in the Pogues, then we're going to actually, it's going to detract from what we're actually doing here. You know, we need Shane's language, if you know what I mean.
The fact that you're still singing and performing and touring his words, does that, performing those songs so closely connected to Shane, Spider, does that in some ways make it harder to let him go? And is that actually okay if that's the case?
Well, I'd say for one thing, they are kind of our songs as well. You know, he may have written the words, but it was the band that actually put the songs together, including Shane. But, you know, obviously the lyrical impetus was that really all came from him. But they're the Pogues songs, and that's the important thing. It's actually, obviously, Shane has gone, but in another way, does anyone ever really die as long as people are sort of remember them? I don't know. It's not about making it hard to let him go. It's not really about that. It's we're doing these songs because, I suppose, if anything, we don't want to let them go. Shane himself, Shane has gone, and Shane, you know, he was very ill. He got to a point his body could no longer fight. So he had done all he could, and he could do no more. So I think someone like Shane will never, you know, he'll never truly go, because listen to the conversation we're having.
Well, listen, you're listening to a legend of Irish music and Second Captain Saturday. Spider Stacey is our first guest of the new series, and he is ready to lay down a marker when it comes to his great sporting achievements. That's up next.
Second captain, first captain, whatever.
On the Roving Row, and a row, and I'll go. On the Roving Row, and a row, and I'll go. On the Roving Row, and a row, and I'll go. For a pair of brown eyes. For a pair of brown eyes.
Yeah, we've got Spider Stacey on Second Captain Saturday today. That's a recording from the first gig you guys headlined with the Pogues in Ireland back in March 1985. A pair of brown eyes. McGonagall's in Dublin. Do you remember anything of the night?
Yeah, I do. Someone tried to steal Jem.
Go on.
Someone, I think it was more than one person. They made a concerted effort just to sort of like grab hold of him and carry him off somewhere. I don't know where they were going to take him, Stony Batter or Palmerstown or somewhere, I imagine, and then do dark things to him.
Sorry, I thought you meant another band or maybe an agent or a representative from the music industry. You're physically talking about some people wanted to bundle him into a car.
This is a kidnapping.
They wanted to abduct him. They obviously didn't. They weren't able to. But yeah, I remember that. It was complete mayhem, that show.
That gig was, not that you care, but that gig was actually reviewed positively in the Irish Times. Very positively.
I know, I do care.
I'll give you the word. You were praised for the honesty and ferociousness of the Pogues' delivery. First time you headlined. So that's what you want, honesty and ferocity.
That's pretty much, that's pretty good. I like that.
All right, let's go from Dublin back to Tip now, Spider, because when we met in London last year, you spoke to me about Shane's funeral and how the realisation came to you that you weren't just saying goodbye to such a good friend and a huge part of your life. It was about much more than that for you.
Yeah. I think, you know, it brought home to me the sort of the sense of occasion. It's hard for me sometimes to put it into words and get them right. It's all quite sort of nebulous, and it's more about kind of feelings and vibes and actual sort of words that you can actually sort of, sometimes, you know, words aren't enough. And, you know, you're saying goodbye to someone who's been very important to yourself personally, but is also, you're also aware that this is something that reaches beyond, that this person, the impact that this person and through this person you yourself have actually had on, if not the world, then a good, you know, fair portion of it, it's all quite... It's something that is much bigger than any of us. You apprehend that there is a sort of a deeper significance to all this than you're just merely sort of like at someone's funeral, seeing the parting glass, bidding them farewell. There's more to it than that.
Yeah.
It's complicated further by the fact that, you know, we were doing it. The funeral was in Nina. And if you knew Shane, you knew just how important Tipperary was to him. You know, I'd say more important to him than anywhere else in the world, including London. You know, Shane loved London, and London, you know, was his canvas, and London was where he kind of grew up. But Ireland, and in particular Tipperary, was, you know, that's where his soul was. His heart's in Tipperary wherever he goes, you know.
Yeah, the line. Could Tipperary ever live up to the real Tipperary ever live up to the Tipperary of his imagining? You know, like the way you speak about it there, it kind of sounds like it was his land of lost content or whatever that line is, but he had put so much of his character into loving Ireland despite being away from Ireland for vast swathes, and that's why he loved Tipperary, that's why he loved Nina.
I think Nina represented a real, it was like a sanctuary to him, for one thing. I mean, he did have this idealised view of Ireland that would kind of manifest itself in quite sort of like strange ways sometimes. Like Irish boxers were always the best boxers, you know, and it wasn't really like, you know, yeah, Shane, but, you know, Muhammad Ali's like, no, you know, yeah, he's great. Obviously Muhammad Ali's great. Mike Tyson's great. But I'm just saying, and then it's sort of like, you know, he'd announced that Barry McGuigan could have beaten up Mike Tyson. Something like that. That sort of thing, do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Okay, it's time to get down to the serious sporting business now and your shot at the greatest non-sportsperson sportsperson title. We've heard you're a tip fan, but hurling wasn't your first sporting love, obviously. You're a lifelong Arsenal fan, for starters. What's your first footballing memory?
It was the 1966 World Cup final.
Wow.
And my mum, by that point, was now working in a hotel in Burlingap in Sussex, which is really just a hotel and a couple of houses, which might have fallen off the cliff by now. The World Cup final was on. I didn't really realise it was a World Cup final. And I walked into the bar. I was about 7 years old. And the game's on. And someone says, it's a World Cup final, you know, it was England and West Germany. And all I really knew was, or my take on this game was, that, you know, I know that there's been two wars we've had against Germany and we've won both of those. So really, I think maybe it might be nice if the Germans won this football match. And which I announced to some of these guys in the bar who had like obviously all sort of like had actually sort of fought in the Second World War against Germans. And so possibly their view is a, well, yeah. It, well, my take on it didn't go down very well.
Yeah, I can imagine that. All right, well, it's getting to a crucial time in the show now. We need to announce the sporting highlight of your own life. And this is a very impressive one because you have contributed directly to the glory years of Irish soccer.
Well, a major contribution.
Well, I mean, you're the central character. You wrote a song for the Irish football team ahead of Italia 90. It was called Jack's Heroes, performed by the Pogues and the Dubliners, penned by Spider Stacey, no less. How did all that come about?
Yeah, we were asked to write a song for the Irish World Cup team. It was as simple as that. And Shane didn't get round to doing it, but I did. And it was originally, actually, I had the bright idea of writing it to the tune of The Sash. But I just thought, you know.
Why didn't it take? I can't understand.
I don't know. I actually don't know. Because that's why the first lines are, they were green and they are beautiful. It was, they were green and they are beautiful. Which I thought it would have been quite. But someone said, no, better not do that. So it's actually, I think, The Wild Colonial Boy. There was actually going to be a B-side to the tune of Spancel Hill. And the lyrics went something like, last night as we were winning 5-0 against Brazil, I saw the flags of green and gold above the seven hills. I something, 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 home, as I watched us lift the World Cup above the walls of Rome.
Wow.
Yeah. I think we got as far as having Ronnie Drew sing maybe that verse, but it never went any further than that. The video for Jack's Heroes is a sight to see.
Oh, it's a sight to see. All right, we have seen it. This tune, it's also a major earworm, so get ready for that. We play a little bit of Jack's Heroes, Spider. Might get you some extra points.
Let's have a listen to a little bit of Jack's Heroes.
From London, Boston, and New York, from anywhere at all, from Parramatta to Fermoy, Strabane to Skibbereen. And will the show go up when the World Cup is raised on Stephen's Green?
Yes, it will!
Sure.
So that's Ronnie Drew singing the Spider Stacey lyrics. From Parramatta to Fermoy, Strabane to Skibbereen, and will the shout go up when the World Cup is raised on Stephen's Green? Yes, it will. That is strong, strong stuff as football songs go now. It stands the test of time. Because you got to think as well, Spider, about the other competitors of the time. You know, chief among them, Give It a Lash, Jack, featuring lyrics like, Maradona, Maradona, keep him from the ball till he begs. Look behind you, poor Diego. Mick McCarthy, bite your legs. So, I mean, you're winning that one. That's a 5-0 victory for you there.
I think so.
Yeah, we've posted the video for this song on Instagram, by the way, so you can all have a look. It was shot at Talca Park. It features the Pogues and the Dubliners, and something I never needed to see, which is Ronnie Drew, John Sheehan, Eamon Campbell and Barney McKenna in shorts. The hairiest and palest five-a-side team of all time.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Now, I should also say the Pogues themselves looked better in shorts, but didn't really display any sporting ability whatsoever.
No, that's true. That's true. I did actually have to foul our guitar tech because he did have sporting ability. And so I had to bring him down with a scything knee-high tackle.
Yeah.
Ronnie Drew, by the way, is 10 years younger in this video than Spider is now. It's just remarkable.
Oh my word.
Ronnie, he just looks like Ronnie Drew always looks.
Yeah.
Bar in a pair of shorts, I suppose. What are your memories? Do you have any clear memories of that video shoot?
Well, apart from my brutal foul on Charlie Malcolm and Barney McKenna, just somehow getting tangled up with the goal net, I think trying to save a penalty. Yeah. I believe lakes of Guinness were consumed.
Before, during, or after?
Yeah, all of those. All of the above.
Was Shane any good at football?
No. God, no. He's hopeless. He's worse than me.
Okay, it's time to rank your sporting life, Spider. One last quick question I want to ask before we do that, though, which may forever ruin your punk image and your street cred. Is it true Spider Stacey now does reformer Pilates?
Yep. Street cred be damned.
Ooh, will this breaking news work for or against you? That's my job done. Your fate is now in the hands of Murph here. Scores to bear in mind, by the way. Rady Pete of Lancome scored 75.5 points, an unusual score, 15 of which Murph gave her for coming in studio. So that was generous. Andy Irvine of Planksy hit 77 points. Respectable stuff there. But now, Kieran, can you please rank this sporting life of Spider Stacey?
You don't understand. I could have had class.
We don't have stars in this game, Mrs. Weaver.
Or do you have them?
People like me.
I could have been a contender. I could have been somebody.
Well, Spider, the time has come. For those unfamiliar with the concept, and I'm sure you're not among them, it is now time for me to assess your sporting ability, pick a sports person that I feel most closely resembles you and your sporting achievements, and then, having considered your all-time sporting highlight, which you've just given us, give you points out of 100 to see if you'll be crowned our greatest non-sports person sportsperson of 2025. The reformer Pilates is no joke. I don't know how much you know about it, but it is an extreme workout.
Looks tough.
It is a sporting outlet more commonly associated with ripped women in their 20s, but it's nevertheless very much to be commended. Your magnanimous support for the Germans in 1966 was the ultimate act of sportsmanship, reminding me of Arsene Wenger replaying that FA Cup match against Sheffield United because Kanu didn't pass the ball back after an injury delay. Your sporting highlight, riding Jack's Heroes, is without parallel. It's the ultimate contribution to the sporting lexicon that any truly great artist can make. And I do mean that. We believe Jack's Heroes hasn't received the respect it deserves, and we want that to change from today. Now, of course, I didn't mention the other Italian 90 Stone Cold classic, Put 'Em Under Pressure, sung by the Irish football team, produced by Larry Mullen, Jack Charlton himself, on vocals. It's a legendary song. But they ripped off Jerry Doone by the Horseps, and this was an original composition by Spider. So as far as I'm concerned, the case is closed. The video for Jack's Heroes is also our only documentary filmed evidence of your capabilities as a sports person, and the results are, I'm afraid,
middling at best.
Uneven. Was your first touch at the international level? Had you the required aerobic stamina? These are questions that were not answered satisfactorily. You did look better in shorts than Barney McKenna, but is that enough? Is it enough?
I would say yes.
In the end, taking all in all, and with all due respect to this most august and serious of tasks, I'm proud to give you 74 points and an early lead in this year's race to the top. Spider Stacey, this has been your sporting life.
Can I just say, Spider, it's an early lead because you're our first guest.
Nah.
I don't know how high a score it is you've been delivered there. Are you happy with 74 points?
I'm happy with 74 points.
And remember, Owen, you know, they changed, they made the Leaving Cert harder and then and then much easier, and now they've gone back to harder. So who knows, 74 points in 2025?
Could be enough.
Could get them all the way.
Could it get me into Europe, do you think?
Yeah, I mean, listen, I'd say mid-table respectability at least.
Well,
and let's
respectability
build from
is better than mediocrity.
Spider, you've been absolutely brilliant. It's been a real pleasure. Good luck with the rest of the tour as well. Thank you so much for chatting to us today.
Thank you very much.
A round of applause, please, for Spider Stacey.
Every day.
I'm a Man You Don't Meet Every Day from Rum, Sodomy and the Lash, Cacho Reardon on vocals, Spider Stacey, today's competitor on Tin Whistle. That was out almost 40 years ago now. Spider Stacey's a man you don't meet every day either. What an absolute legend. Yeah, he was up for tip last week, quite clear about that. No skin in the game tomorrow, as far as I know, for the football final. I have to say, this is as excited as I've been for a long time about an All-Ireland football final. Two legendary managers, proper superstar in each team, David Clifford for Kerry, Donegal's Michael Murphy, who, as people will know if they follow the game, retired for 2 years, he was gone.
Yep.
Worked with us as a pundit in that time. Now he's back, better than ever, and on the verge of leading his team to only their third All-Ireland in their history. That's a pretty good story.
Yeah, the Murphy thing is... It's ridiculous in a lot of ways. I mean, I left this studio on this day last year, as in the Saturday before the All-Ireland football final. I met our hurling analyst, Jamie Wall, for a pint outside Grogan's, right? Grogan's, Dublin City Centre institution. Who walks past as we're enjoying our pint? Michael Murphy, right?
Yeah, yeah.
So on this day last year, I had a couple of pints with Michael Murphy, just having the crack in the most, literally the most relaxed fashion possible. And now here we are, that 1 year later to the day.
And he doesn't answer your calls, Murph.
Well, we actually swore to each other that we'd do this every Saturday before the All-Ireland football final. But so I mean, I presume he's going to be there in
Should
like
be.
An hour or something.
Should
funnily enough, on yes, not answering my text this weekend. But crazy, absolutely crazy.
Is he going to win it?
The closer I get to it, the more I think Donegal are going to win.
Oh, yeah?
Are going to win tomorrow. But honestly, I don't have a dog in the fight. I actually just really want to see David Clifford and Michael Murphy have amazing games, both of them, and let's see what happens.
Very magnanimous of you. You can listen to more of that.
Extremely boringly magnanimous. But there we go. Yes.
You can listen to Murph and I in the Second Captains podcast with the rest of our team from Monday to Friday, wherever you get your pods, or through secondcaptains.com, where you can also hear the Second Captains produced international podcast series, Where is George Gibney? And Steak Knife. We're back here next week and every Saturday for the next couple of months. This is a Second Captains production for RTE, produced by Killian Down. Mark Horgan is a series producer for Second Captains. Thanks to Johnny Lanagan in RTE. Thank you, Murph.
Thank you, Owen.
Thanks so much for listening. We'll see you again next week.
Second Captain, First Captain, whatever.